This is RTE Radio 1. It's 6 minutes past seven and time now for The Book Show.
This is The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. On tonight's show, we look at some Irish books and judge them solely on their cover design.
Every single cover was designed by somebody Irish, so the visual language of it is fascinating what they thought might appeal to the Irish public.
And we explore European fiction in a new anthology by Dawkey Archive, which brings together the work of writers from 28 countries.
The cows, whose expressions wavered somewhere between placid and depressed, let the hypermarket of fluorescent lights burning unrelentingly into the night go by.
First, though, this evening, Hanif Qureshi's new book, The Last Word, is a satirical novel which charts the relationship between an ambitious young biographer, Harry Johnson, and his subject, Mamoon Azam, an elderly Indian novelist. The novel is about conversation and two people coming together to tell each other stories. When I spoke to Hanif, I asked him why the dialogue won out.
Well, I tried to make it not as talky and put more description in, but actually it was the talk that was the most alive in it, really. Because in a way, most of what I do all day when I'm not writing is talk to other people. And it's amazing how dramatic your conversations are with other people and how quickly your whole life, let's say, can change if someone says a certain thing to you, or how, let's say, dramatic conversations are with children, you know, and the terrible things they can suddenly say to you, and you can find yourself saying back to them, and you think, I only walked into the kitchen to make a cup of tea, and my son has told me how much he hates me twice, for instance. So it seemed to me that really dramatic, important things happen when people are talking.
What is the tension between the two men in this book, do you think?
Well, this is a story about two men, a younger man and an older man. Two writers, really, and one writer really wants to find out about the other writer. And the older writer, is pretty resistant to being found out about, because he thinks that that the view that the younger man has of him is rather simplistic. It's like, as he says, having your life read back to you by an idiot. So what I'm interested in, really, is storytelling and who has the authority. I mean, the older writer is the novelist, and he tells us the truth about the world, as I do, through fibs, through telling lies, through making up things. And he thinks that's where we get close to reality, in that roundabout way. And the other chap, the younger boy, thinks that he can tell the truth about the older writer by finding out more facts about him or getting more knowledge of him. But the older writer is rather puzzled by this, because somehow all the facts don't add up somehow to a life. It's like, it would be like if somebody wrote down all the facts about your life, and somehow you'd say, well, the good bit, the interesting bit is missing here somehow. So this is a question about knowing people and about knowing the world. And I was thinking the other day that knowing the world isn't that interesting. When I read a poem that I really like, I was reading one this morning that I really liked, I felt the world was a much better place after it. I didn't feel that I knew the world better, but I just felt cheered up by this writer had somehow enhanced the world for me.
And if you might read a section from The Last Word for us and tell us a bit about what you're going to read.
This is a scene of Mahmood's birthday party. Harry, the young biographer, begins to realise that he might have a story. And part of the story means writing about this, in fact, very birthday party that he's present at, that he might capture in this sort of semi-fictional, fictionalized way, a picture of this grumpy old great writer. Harry, realizing it might be a good idea to feature this scene of summing up and farewell in his introduction, had been making notes all the while. Once the speeches were over, he went outside for some fresh air, and sitting on a wall, added some information and color about the guests. He wouldn't present only the facts. He wanted a more novelistic, personal tone, presenting the writer in his later years, puffed with success and honours.
In terms of the idea of, say, a story like My Son the Fanatic, which was quite prophetic in lots of ways if you look at the London terrorist attacks, why did you write about that issue particularly? And is there something, did you ever get to a place of fear where you thought, I shouldn't write about this, I can't address this? How did you feel about tackling that subject? Because again, we're talking about it more now than we were before those attacks.
I became fascinated in the 80s after being in Pakistan. by this new sort of cult, which was this version of Islam that had come out of Egypt, from the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was developing in Pakistan, and my uncles used to talk about it a lot. And then obviously, much later, we all became aware of it in Britain after the fatwa against Rushdie. And then I spent some time with those kids at the mosques and the schools and mostly the colleges. And I was fascinated by them because they were fanatical about, as it were, closing the world down. The world had become very narrowed by this religion. There were only certain things you could think, say, or do. And I was fascinated by why anybody would want all that constraint and why it would be so satisfying. And not only that, I became fascinated by sacrifice. Why the idea, as it were, you would give up what else was around you, why you would sacrifice yourself, why the son, as it were, why does the son sacrifice himself for the father, and why does the father demand that, and what are you doing in this sort of masochistic disavowal of your own self? I was fascinated by that, what was going on, what people were giving up, you know, because my father and other men and women of my parents' generation came to Britain, as it were, for more. For what Britain, as it were, had to offer in terms of its liberalism. But these kids were giving up everything that seemed to me to be worth having in the liberal West. And that's a fascinating sacrifice. So I just got really interested in it. I think it's the most interesting thing. And obviously it has become a huge force and power in the world. I mean, as other forms of religion have diminished, this is a form of religion that has actually, you know, expanded and become more powerful during our time. And not only that, as you know, has had huge impact on our lives, and we will continue to live with it.
Honey, if you're going to read a little section from My Son the Fanatic, maybe you'd tell us a bit about the section you're going to read before you start.
This is a story about a man who is a taxi driver, an immigrant to Britain, and this odd thing starts to happen to his son. He realises that his son is not studying anymore, he's selling his possessions, that the son is becoming very devout and religious, an unusual thing in their family. Parvez had been a taxi driver for 20 years. Half that time he'd worked for the same firm. Like him, most of the other drivers were Punjabis. They preferred to work at night. The roads were clearer and the money better. They slept during the day, avoiding their wives. Together they led almost a boy's life in the cabbie's office, playing cards and practical jokes, exchanging lewd stories, eating together and discussing politics and their problems. But Parvez had been unable to bring this subject up with his friends. He was too ashamed. And he was afraid, too, that they would blame him for the wrong turning his boy had taken, just as he had blamed other fathers whose sons had taken to running around with bad girls, truanting from school and joining gangs.
That conflict recurs in a lot of your work, the idea of a conflict between husband and wife or father and son, and then themes like being an outsider or sex or lack of passion or all these things. Why do you think these themes recur in your work? And it's the same for a lot of writers. They go back to the same ideas and concepts over again. Why do you return to them?
I return to the themes you talked about, well, because they matter to me, particularly as a young man, the notion of identity or the notion of race, and certainly growing up in Britain as a mixed-race kid in the 60s and 70s. Certainly the influence, say, of people like Enoch Powell and so on made me think a great deal about Britain, about the empire and about one's place in it, about multiculturalism, and certainly later on about religion, Islam, and so on. I write about sex, sexuality, and desire because it's at the centre of people's lives, and who and how they want matters more to them than anything else. And I write about relationships for the same reason. My last movie that I did with my dear friend Roger Michel, Le Weekend, is about one of the most important things, which is about a marriage, about a couple who go to Paris and find out if they want to be together and what's between them. And that seems to me to be very important and something that, you know, we all live through. And an important question, really, which it's about, which is, when does the relationship end? And how do you know it's ended?
Which is a big question, because there is a lot of sexual unhappiness and promiscuity in your stories, and it's a big motivator for a lot of those characters, but it seems like, is it an obvious motivator? Does it make utter sense that it is such a compulsion for them?
Well, it's a central question for anybody. What is their sexuality to them? What place does it have in their lives, and what do they want to do with it, and how do they use it, as it were, to get to know other people better and themselves, or to evade other people. It seems to me that to be the most important thing is, which is, who do we want to be with, and in what sense do we desire them, and how long do we desire them for, and what happens to us if and when that desire runs out.
There is a sense in the new book that legacy and mortality loom large, particularly because we have a writer at the end of his life who's wondering what's going to be left behind, what his story is going to be left behind. Do you think that that's a natural preoccupation when a writer gets to a certain point of their life? I mean, Martin Amis and Philip Roth and John Banville have all written about this.
No, it's not really, because I don't think there's anything that I can do about it. I mean, I've written the books, I've written them, and written the films I've written, and there they are. And people will make of them what they will. And when you look at the work of other artists and the lives of other artists, you can see in some sense the artists couldn't do anything about it. So you might say, well, I worry about it. But one of the things you do think about as you get older, which is something much more interesting than that, which is about how you've lived and what mattered to you. And the relationships you've managed to succeed in and to fail in your life, in terms of women, in terms of children, in terms of friendship and so on. I mean, I think that you think about that a lot after the age of 50, and I think that that then will produce new writing, actually. That's what I want to do. When I get up in the morning, I want to get up in the morning and be inspired and write something that I haven't written before. So if I think about my life, I would think about it in terms of, is there a new way I can think about the past, actually, that would make more work? That's what I want to do. I still want to work.
It's been a long time since you've written a novel, and that the last word being the title, that's not in any way an indication that you're going to slow down or stop writing.
No, I'm still writing. I write a lot. I mean, I have written a lot. I wrote a whole book that I didn't publish. I've written a lot of essays. I've written a lot of stories that I also haven't published. I've written other films that I haven't been made and so on. So one of the reasons I didn't publish this novel for so long was that I couldn't face all the present publicity that you have to do, actually. You know, the endless going around the world. It just seemed really tiring to me, and I wanted to write more. So I just thought, you know, why publish them at all? But after a while, you realise, if you're sensible, that you've got to have contact with an audience. You've actually got to write for other people. But it's not something you can just do on your own, otherwise you go mad.
Thanks to Hanif Qureshi there for taking the time at least to talk to us here on The Book Show. The Last Word is published by Faber. Now, designer Niall McCormack recently wrote the introduction for Vintage Values, a book gathering together the cover art of Catholic pamphlets. Zoe Cummins went to meet with him to discuss Irish book covers.
I'm here looking through Niall McCormack's book and pamphlet collection.
This is kind of the newer material that I've picked up. So it's all in cardboard boxes. That's more just to kind of keep a handle on it.
Of particular interest are the religious pamphlets produced in their thousands by the Roman Catholic Church for decades.
So these would have been on display in the, you know, at the back of churches, just in a stand, you know. So they really were a piece of kind of popular ephemera that was in every home.
The pamphlets have moralistic titles like Divorce is a Disease and What to Do on a Date, but carefully packaged in fresh, modern covers.
So what we're looking at here is a little pamphlet. My mind wanders, and this is sort of a 1920s capitalised script.
Yeah, it's kind of Art Deco font, really.
And we have several men in church, all with their head bowed, except for one man at the back who is, obviously, his mind is wandering.
Yeah, he's having trouble.
And there seem to be quite a few of these Catholic pamphlets.
I believe around 5,000 were published over the life of the Catholic Truth Society, and they published pamphlets right up until the very early 70s, although it kind of petered off at that stage.
Have a look at this box here. So what have we got here?
Fashionable Sin is the title, and it's a kind of a devil's head, a side profile of it, and it's filled then with kind of cartoon, lots of, you know, people whispering gossip.
And it really is the head of Lucifer, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But it's rendered in a kind of pop graphic style.
Girls were girls and boys were boys when I was a top. Now we don't know who is who or who, but what's what.
Many of the pamphlets we're looking at were written by Daniel A. Lord, SJ.
He wrote an awful lot, you'll see. His name pops up an awful lot. He was quite a prolific pamphleteer. But these were written, his ones would have been written for what is called the Catholic Truth Society of America. He kind of framed the Hays Code and did an awful lot of anti, what was considered obscenity within Hollywood in that period. He was a big driver of the kind of clampdown on Hollywood's kind of malign influence. But obviously within Ireland, we were even more kind of fearful of the encroachment of American popular culture into our world, you know. We think of that period as being, of Ireland being very cut off from the world, but the more I've kind of looked at this particular subject, I realise actually most of the designers were fully au fait with international trends and they were quite aware of what was going on. So a lot of what the church was bringing out had quite a modernist sort of a slant to it visually.
So it may seem quite twee to us now, but it is that notion of let's get our message out there in popular culture and do it and bind it up in an attractive way with a good cover on it, and it may just sell.
Every single cover was designed by somebody Irish, so the visual language of it is it's fascinating what they're drawing on and what the influences are and kind of what they thought might appeal to the Irish public.
As well as pamphlets, Niall has a large collection of Irish books.
Days of Fear, Diary of a Hunger Strike, Alfie Lam.
And many of these have really noteworthy covers.
This is actually pretty nicely designed. You know, some people mightn't appeal to them, but it conforms to kind of notions of good design.
So what we're looking at here is a small paperback, The Council Reconsidered by Louis McRedmond. And on one side we have a simple black and white illustration of a dome, but on the other side, in a kind of a diagonally cut across the page of the front cover, we have a very simple line drawing of a more modern church.
It's kind of an abstracted church. I mean, it almost could be a coffin by the shape of the dome there. I suppose what it's saying is here's tradition and here is modernity, and here, you know, so the book is kind of looking at the new world that the church has entered in the early 70s.
It's very interesting because the story is told there in just two very simple pictures. You can tell so much about it by what's going on in the cover.
You can. With this sort of design, that's central to sort of the modernist thinking, is to kind of communicate an awful lot with very limited means. You know, deliberately kind of strip back what you have, but use symbolism and it's to be kind of suggestive but slightly ambiguous as well about the content. So it draws you in.
So how do we in Ireland stack up against international design?
But internationally, people are generally, the obsessions seem to be very similar no matter what country you go to. I mean, you could go to Turkey and collect Turkish book covers and you would find a lot of the same, you know, mainly because production techniques and printing kind of technology advances at a certain speed. So when letterpress is in, everything looks a certain way, and then when that goes out and offset lithography comes in, everything moves to looking that way, and that happens globally. You know, when the Macintosh computer comes in, it wasn't like we were sitting in Ireland and then 10 years later we got Macintosh computers. The minute they came out, we had them, you know. This notion that there's a time lag between the world developing something and us getting it, you know, up there. You know, there hasn't been a technology invented where we've waited a decade to get into it. But that seems to be the perception, that we are, oh, we're kind of slow and we're backward. And I don't know why we let ourselves believe that, but it's never been the case, you know.
And definitely not with book design, because as I can see here, we really are. I mean, we match anything that you see internationally, and it's so nice to see it all in one place. So thanks a million for showing it to me.
Thanks very much.
And that was Zoe Cummins there talking to Niall McCormick. You can check out Niall's website, hightone.ie, that's HITONE.ie, and Vintage Values Classic Pamphlet Cover Design from 20th Century Ireland is available online at veritasbooksonline.com. Finally tonight, Dorky Archive Press have just published their third anthology of European fiction. I went to meet with some of the writers and Drago Yanchar, who wrote the introduction to this new anthology, and asked him what he found refreshing about the collection.
I am a curious reader. I would like to read as much as it is possible. And usually I read the things which are somehow already established through the publishers and so on. Now I had opportunity to read the people I didn't know. Many of them I didn't know. There were some names I knew before. And so it was adventure to jump into every story, to different aesthetics, to different experience of life, not only life, also politics and societies.
Susana Medina, you're one of the contributing writers to this anthology. You're a Spanish writer. Do you think there's such a thing that you can define what European fiction is?
It is a very difficult one because Europe is, of course, huge. We have 28 countries in this anthology. I don't think you can. At the same time, I think there's something. I always get the feeling that we have more of an existentialist tradition. Many countries have more of a, you know, Europe has suffered a lot. Has, you know, every country has its own concept. Like Portugal has saudade. You know, in English, there's this melancholy. The language is suffused with it. So, and I just think that all that is just very different from the States.
Robert Mahinick, you're a Welsh writer, and you were nodding along as Susanna was talking there. Do you think you can define European fiction?
Well, it's quite difficult to define British and Irish fiction. There are so many languages in the UK and Ireland that don't often get represented. So trying to encompass the whole of Europe, where every country would have its own so-called minority languages as well, it's impossible to try to make an anthology that is truly representative. But I think this it's brave and ambitious, and it's great to be part of it.
Robert, in terms of, we're talking about overlap and possible themes, and one of the things that stands out with your stories is the structure of it, the way it's physically laid out on the page. Would you tell us a bit about that before you read from your story?
It's a short story, but it's structured as I might organise a poem. I see Scavenger as a poem written out in prose. In reality, Scavenger is a letter from the future, but I think it's quite applicable to recent events in the UK and Ireland because of the enormous tides that have changed the coastline of the UK and Ireland and uncovered certain things. And I think in the future, we'll be undergoing certain climatic changes which will create drama in our lives. Breathing. That's what I can hear. The stone breathing. It's what I've always heard in Pink Bay. No, not the sea sighing, because sometimes the tide is far away. But in this place, where the limestone meets the sandstone, the red bleeds into the grey, I can hear the stone itself, its ancient exhalation. I didn't think like that as a child. It's something I gradually learn I'm able to do if I pay enough attention, because that's something I'm good at, paying attention. If I listen long enough, I hear the sound of stone breathing.
And that was Robert Mahinick reading from Scavenger. Robert, you're obviously writing in your first language, and Susanna, your translator, Rosie, is here with us also. Rosie, what's your experience of working in translating, working in a second language?
Well, actually, it's quite unique working with Susanna because Susanna is, as you'll have heard, bilingual, although obviously her native language is Spanish. So actually we co-translate it's quite a mutual project between the two of us. In the case of this story, I worked solely on the story before sharing it with Susanna, then we can have a lot of work between us afterwards to look at the choices I've made, how they reflect on Susanna's original choices. And actually, sometimes she goes back and feels she wants to change the original, which is a really precious place to be in as a translator. Quite fortunate, I feel. And the other thing with Susanna's writing is that she has been influenced by English. She's lived in England for many years, and without her necessarily knowing it, English weaves its way into her Spanish, and so I sort of get to bring it back out again.
El verde orgásmico desaparecía, pero se intensificaba su olor.
At dusk, the orgasmic green would disappear, but its smell became stronger. The cows, whose expressions wavered somewhere between placid and depressed, let the hypermarket of fluorescent lights burning unrelentingly into the night go by. The thought of the cows made her remember a paper she'd read somewhere, a study carried out by a genetic engineer who had decided that cows didn't need heads, and so was working to alter their DNA so that they were born headless, with nothing but a tube with which to suck in nutrition.
And that was Rosie Marto reading from Susanna Medina's story, Estrogen. Drago, if I could just ask you, this anthology has existed, but this is your first year being the editor of the anthology. Why do you think pulling together all this diverse work in multiple languages in translated form is so important? Why does this anthology matter?
In life, diversity is beautiful. In literature, diversity and variety is beautiful. We cannot have only one stream, and it is beautiful in nowadays Europe. It was there were times there were periods in European history when we had some big realistic Roman novel, and then we had existentialism from France and other streams which overwhelm all Europe all the time. But now nothing like this is going on. It's a big fragmentarization and big, a great focus on individual prismas, or individual optics, how they work. And this is a value, I think. This is important. Europe can be joined politically, economically, but on literary way, the diversity will remain, thanks God.
And that's all we've time for this week. If you want to listen back to the show, you can do so via rte.ie or on iTunes. On the show next week, we visit the home of J.P. Dunleavy. But for this week, we'll leave you with Regan Hutchins and a footnote about books that are worth burying.
Recently, Armistead Maupin announced the end for his Tales of the City, which first appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1976. His weekly stories of animadrigal, free love and cannabis plants at 28 Barbary Lane were punched out in a serialised form that harkened back to the 19th century, when novels were routinely drip-fed in periodicals. The town was hooked. In 1978, Tales of the City was published as a novel, and the next year it was buried in a time capsule celebrating all things San Franciscan. Let's hope that when unearthing the treasure, a future generation will understand interring a book means people really, really like it.